We're in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 still. Last time when we got together, we were talking about the Lord's reaction, response to the man of the lawlessness, and how he is not only going to reduce the man to his bare essence, spirit, soul, and body, in a place where there is no life at any of those three levels. Not only is he going to do that, according to verse 8, it's not really slaying him, but it is destroying everything about his experience of life and his capacity to experience life as a human being. But also, he's going to bring an end. He's going to bring an end to all of the efforts that the man has engaged in as a part of this whole process of the mystery of lawlessness that's been going on for 6,000 years. And I don't think for an egomaniac that there's anything worse than having everything you've lived your whole life for to accomplish being reduced to nothing. That's going to be a sad day for him. Bring him to an end. Now, this evening we're going to be looking in verse 9 and 10 at the return to the description. The lawless one in verse 7 about the mystery of lawlessness and how it's being restrained now and will be until the one who's doing the restraining steps out of the picture, and then the lawless one will be revealed. And then Paul brings in that response that the Lord gives. And then verse 9, he comes back to the main issue of describing this lawless man. And he says in verse 9 that he is one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of, it's translated wickedness, but it's actually unrighteousness, for those who perish because they don't receive the love of the truth as to be saved. So in our last study, it was the Lord's reaction, and now we're going to be looking at Paul's description of how this man is going to achieve his status in this world before the Lord reacts and brings to pass the complete frustration of his evil intention in this creation. So there are two fundamental issues. One of them is the means of the rise of the man of the lawlessness, or the rise of the Antichrist, the means by which that occurs, and the other one is the reason why God allows it in the first place. So that's where we're going. In the first place, he says that the deception of the lawless man, he talks about the deception particularly in verses 9 and 10, where he comes in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of unrighteousness for those who perish. So the whole issue is a deception issue. And the first description of the roots of this lawless progression has to do with how he is going to be brought to his position in human history so that he is fundamentally the king of the world. He is going to be the ruler of, fundamentally, he's going to be the ruler of a nation, but there's then going to be a coalition of other nations that are in harmony with him, and he's going to be dominant over those, but through that, he'll dominate the vast majority of the world for a short period. And in that whole issue of how in the world does this happen, Paul just point blankly says, well, it's the work of the devil. It's the work of Satan, verse 9. His coming is according to the standard of the activity of Satan. So he's basically saying that this individual, this particular individual in human history, is a climactic development that Satan has been working on for 6,000 years. It just so happens that this individual is the final individual in the whole process. There have been many along the way that have been used by Satan to move this progression forward. Hitler was one. Nero was probably one of the earliest. But there have always been these people in history where the antagonism against the plan of God has been extremely strong, and their goal was to wipe out the people of God. So Paul just says his coming, this lawless one's coming, is according to a given standard. That's that kata plus the accusative. that's translated is in accord with. There is a standard here of Satan's activity. He says, in a sense, that it's Satan's work, because the word translated activity is the word energion, and it means to expend energy in order to accomplish a particular goal. So every time you have something you want to achieve and you set about doing work to achieve it, that's energy. That's the idea. It always has energy expended in view of an objective. And there are certain standards. And Satan's expenditure of energy is according to a given standard in this text. And that given standard is that it fundamentally lays out the nature of the opposition. Because the issue is opposition, that's why he calls him Satan in verse 9. We know that Satan is described and called the devil in many places. This individual is actually called the Antichrist by John in 1 John, when he says, you know that Antichrist comes. But I tell you, even now, there are many Antichrists in the world. Well, the Antichrist that's coming is this final individual. And Paul says it's all about opposition. That's why he calls him according to the standard of Satan. Because the issue of opposition has already been raised in verse 4. This guy, as a tool of Satan, opposes and exalts himself above everything that's called God or any object that is worshipped as a god. So the whole point here is that he's opposing gods. He is trying to be a god. That's according to verse 4. He sets himself in the temple of the God and displays himself as being the God. But all of that terminology, the God terminology with Satan, means that it is all about the quest for the exercise of the power of being able to do what a God does. And God, by definition, is the executor of power. So Satan's whole issue is dominion. He wants to be the boss. He wants to exercise the power in order to force everything to work his way. That's why he's called Satan, because the God, the true God, the one and only God, is God by virtue of the fact he's omnipotent. He is powerful above all of his creation, and there isn't any alliance of powers that can be brought to bear that will be able to topple omnipotence. And so Satan, being deluded by his perception of the character of the current God, the one that we call the eternal and the only God, his misperception of him allows him to believe that somehow or another he'll be able to get into this position of power, because that's what it's all about, power. And his work of opposition has a typical standard. All of his doings are as an opposer. That's why it's called Satan, because that word means opposer. But his energy is expended in a specific way, and that's as the devil, because the word devil means deceiver. So all of Satan's opposition is being done in terms of deception, because that's the only way you can work with created personality, where you have individuals, angelic or human, who have the capacity to think and reason and make choices and pursue activities. In order to get them on your side, in order to get their works to coalesce with what you're trying to have happen, you have got to have a method of getting them to do that. And there are a couple of ways you can do that. One is you can put a gun to their head. And if they're sufficiently afraid of you, you can make them do the work that you want done. And this was demonstrated in both world wars, where you had prisoners of war that were in prison camps, and they put the prisoners to work breaking rocks and building roads and building airstrips and all. They had work that they wanted done, and they forced it by the power of the gun to happen. Well, that's one way you can do it. And in fact, the book of the Revelation says the Antichrist is going to do that by threatening to cut people's heads off if they don't do what he wants them to. So that's one of the methods. But the more subtle method is to get their active cooperation rather than forcing them against their will to get them to cooperate, and the cooperation's always by deceit. You make it look like that they're going to be benefited by it when all along all you're interested in is using them for your own gain. So that standard then is, according to the typical standard of Satan, it is the objective of being a god in the exercise of the power over everything that's being done so I can have what I want, I can get what I want out of it. And that's the first issue that Paul says, that this man's coming is according to this standard. So that his rise is actually Satan's doing, and it means one thing in particular concerning the man of the lawlessness. This man is going to be a major egomaniac. He's going to be as bad or worse than Nebuchadnezzar. He's going to think very, very highly of himself. But the reality is, he's the useful idiot. He's the individual that Satan has decided he'll most fundamentally deceive so that he can get his total cooperation. He'll promise him the kingdoms of this world, if you'll fall down and worship me, kind of terminology. But in the final analysis, it's Satan that's doing this, and it's Satan's objective, and he isn't going to give the ability to dominate to anybody else. His goal is to have himself in that position. So this man, as arrogant and successful as he appears to be, is really nothing more than a useful idiot. He's just somebody who is being used by Satan to gather all of the power of the human beings that are in this creation to come together in agreement to accomplish his ends. So that's the first thing that we're told about the roots of the rise of this man. It's all satanic, and that's why the mystery of the lawlessness started way back in Genesis 3 and has been building over the last 6,000 years, gradually increasing and increasing with a deliberate restrainer, the Spirit of God restraining in the working, causing frustration on Satan's part in many occasions, but also allowing him to achieve a certain amount of success over a long period of time. So that's the first thing we're told. It comes from Satan's activity, his expenditure of energy to accomplish his goal. The second thing that we're told is that there are certain particulars to this standard, according to the standard of the energizing or the energy expenditures of Satan himself. And the first thing that's characteristic is, it's power. It's all about power. The word that's translated power there is the typical word dunamis. It means that you actually have the ability to accomplish the objective that you set forth. Dunamis is the ability to actually accomplish the objective that you have in mind. So Satan has this objective. He wants to be the God. Well, in bringing this man up to the point where he gets humanity to be basically committed to his agenda, as deceptive as that is, nonetheless, he is going to exercise a certain effectiveness in bringing that to pass. So the most fundamental issue of any God in the minds of human beings has always been illustrated in history by this ability to achieve. We comment on guys like Alexander the Great. He's called Alexander the Great because he was able to, by superior strategies, often defeat armies that were far larger than his and had far more resources than he did. But he, by stratagem, he would attack them when they weren't expecting it, and he would do the things that were necessary to defeat them. And he actually, with a few hundred thousand men, destroyed over a million-man army. So that's the whole idea of a god, somebody who can manipulate and strategize and use power to accomplish these objectives. And in the Old Testament, that was one of the major things. I mean, when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, when the Israelites very foolishly thought that if they'd bring the Ark to the battlefield, that would automatically mean they'd win. When they lost the battle and the Philistines took over the Ark, they took it to their God's house. And they set it there beside their god. And the next morning, their god was on his face in front of this. So they set him back up, and the next day, he's back on his face in front of the Tsar. Well, the whole point there is that the god is the one who can force the other gods to submit. And my god's bigger than your god was the main idea. And the Assyrians, when they came down into Jerusalem, the challenge was, don't let this king or any of your prophets talk you into resisting us, because our gods have already proven that they're superior to all the gods. We've been able to defeat everybody that we've attacked, and you'll be no different. And so how did the true God react to that? Well, he killed 900,000 of them in the night. You know, they were all dead the next morning. What's that prove? It proves that the God that's got the power is the God. That's the way people think. And that's really the reason why we call him a God in the first place, is because the English word God goes back to the Greek theos, which goes back to the Hebrew El, or Elohim, the executor of power. So, one of the issues is that the first characteristic of Satan is that he's bought into this power thesis. He really believes that the bottom line is the one who has the power. And in some respects, that's true. But it's not true. It's not really true. It's a deception. It's delusion. He's self-deluded. But because that's his approach, and because humanity has bought into that argument that the most important characteristic of God is omnipotence, because they bought that, Satan's approach is to use it. So what's he do? He uses it with powers and signs and false wonders. There are three things that are going on. One is the power, which is the ability to achieve these things. So if the Antichrist can demonstrate his ability to achieve his objectives, everybody will follow him simply because he's got the power. And it's interesting that that issue of power is in the book of the Revelation, a fundamental issue of the power. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the second thing is the use of the word signs. The word signs is semon, and it basically means, you know, a lot of times we'll have perhaps joking comment, it must be a sign. Somebody will be saying something about trying to figure out something God wants, and they'll say, well, this happened, that must be a sign. It's a sign. Well, we're not using the word right, because the word sign means that the event or the activity or whatever you're calling the sign actually has built into it the characteristics of the type of meaning that is associated with whatever it's pointing to. And it's in other words, it's a sign that points to something, and it points to it with the characteristics that are involved in that thing. So, when we have a sign, we have a physical level illustration of something that's true in another domain, spiritual or soulish or whatever. And that's the basic idea of human understanding of signs, because signs exist to teach us beyond our grasp of the realms that we're limited to. We live as sensory perceiving creatures. We have five senses, and we can touch, taste, smell, so on. Plus, we can reason. So with those capacities, we can pretty well understand our physical creation to some degree. And everywhere in the Bible, God has used the physical realities that we understand to push us to understand the relational universe that he's created. So Jesus taught parables. This, the kingdom of God is like unto, and then he'll use some thing that everybody's familiar with, and he'll make an application from that to our understanding of the kingdom of God. And he'll say things like, well, you've got to be born again. You won't see or enter the kingdom if you're not born again. Well, Nicodemus was hung up on the material reality. Being born means I got to get back in my mom's womb. No, that's not what that means, but that's where he was thinking. So in the issue of signs, the basic idea is human beings only understand further developments in other realms as they understand their own domain. And so there's a thing that points to that, a sign points to that. Even calling God our Father is a sign. Human fathers are a sign. They point to God as a father. The sad thing about that is that they're typically not a very good sign because their behavior and character isn't good enough. But nonetheless, that's the way our language works. And it's interesting that in Revelation 13:13, John uses this word signs to identify the kinds of things that the man of sin, the lawless man who's working his according to the energy of Satan, the kinds of things he'll be able to do. And there are two major ones. One of them is that the Antichrist is going to, he's going to attack God's two witnesses that are identified in Revelation. And the book of Revelation says that these two witnesses have the power to speak death to anybody that tries to harm them. Fire going out of their mouth and devouring their adversaries. And anybody that tries to harm them, this is the way they'll handle it. Well, you know, after three or four people get fried by the reaction of the two witnesses because they try to harm them, either snipers or whatever, assassins or whatever, they kill them. Well, after a few of those kind of events, everybody's scared to death of these two witnesses. They don't want to try to harm them because the last time they got somebody tried to harm them, they got killed. And the time before that happened again, and the time before that happened again. Well, the book of Revelation says the Antichrist is going to kill those two guys. That's going to make a huge impression on the world at large. Because up until he kills them, they haven't been able to be put to death by anybody. So that's one of the issues that's going to be raised. And one of the questions that's raised in light of that is, who is able to make war against the beast? Who has the power to win if they go head to head with him? Because those two guys didn't. And they were the most powerful people we've ever seen operate in this world up until this time. And the other thing is that the guy himself is going to receive a mortal wound, but the mortal wound will then suddenly be, relatively suddenly, I don't know exactly what the time frame is, but the mortal wound will be healed so that the guy is actually going to be able to claim to have come back from the dead. And so by two major ways, these signs are set in place because the ability to destroy your enemies is a sign that you're a god, and the ability to overcome mortal wounds is a sign that you're a god. I mean, the God we worship has actually used those two things. He has defeated his enemies time after time in the Old Testament as a demonstration of who the true God is. And then secondly, he proved that Jesus was his own son by raising him from the dead after being in the grave for, I mean, it was on the third day he raised him from the dead. So that's the kind of thing that this man will be able to produce. Plus, he'll also be able to do the another thing, and we'll talk about that in the lying wonders, the false wonders. So we have powers, the ability to accomplish objectives. We have signs, things that are remarkable demonstrations or pointing to a certain conclusion. And then we have these false wonders. And the impact of a wonder, as it's translated, is identified in Hebrews 2:4. Because in Hebrews 2:4, the author of Hebrews says that the gospel is validated by certain signs and wonders. In other words, it's a validation principle. How do I know that you're speaking the truth? Well, you know I'm speaking the truth by this, and you do something that's remarkable, it's astounding. And everybody says, well, I guess he must be speaking the truth. And that's the way Jesus actually validated his own ministry in this world. He went about preaching and teaching things, and then he went about healing lepers and raising dead people. And, you know, all the miracles that Jesus did are simply arguments that this is a validation. His doctrine's true because this is the validation. And Hebrews 2:4 accepts that. And even the guy that was born blind that Jesus healed, when he got into it with the Pharisees, he said, you know, it's a remarkable thing that ever since the world began, nobody's ever healed a man born blind. and yet you don't know where this guy came from. This is obvious to me. The fact that he was able to heal my blindness proves, as far as I'm concerned, that he is who he says he is. The religious leaders didn't want to accept that as proof, but nonetheless, that was his argument. The sign, the wonder, proves it. And in all cases of understanding that are rooted in the proper interpretation of an act of power or a given sign, there has to be some kind of a validation. You have to be able to validate. Well, Romans 1 says that Jesus was validated as the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. In Satan's case, the validation is either itself fake or the interpretation of it is false. Because the Antichrist is going to have a man called a prophet, a false prophet, but he's going to be able to call fire down from heaven. And that's as obvious a copycat thing of Elijah on Mount Carmel as you can get. And the whole issue on Mount Carmel with Elijah was, who is the true God? The prophets of the Baal and Asherah, there were 950 of them, weren't there? 900 or 950. But anyway, there's a gobble of them. And they were all claiming that their gods were the true gods. And Elijah was by himself and saying, no, my God is the true God. Yahweh is the true God. And I have a little test for you. So he set up the test, and everybody knows how the test came out. The false prophets were unable to get their God to accept their sacrifice, and Elijah just soaked his sacrifice with water 7 times, and then he stepped back and said, okay, God, show them that you're God. Fire fell from heaven, consumed the sacrifice, the altar, and lapped up all the water. And everybody said, Yahweh is God. So what's it going to be like at the end of this development of this principle of lawlessness when this man is in control and he's got this false prophet before him, and this false prophet is saying, that man is the God he says he is, and I can prove it, and he calls fire down from heaven. You know, it says in Matthew 24 that the deception that this guy is going to be able to create is going to be so potent that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived. Because it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to keep your head on straight when the people that you don't believe are doing the very things that are the reason why you believe. I mean, the Israelites believed Yahweh was God because his prophet could call fire down from heaven. Well, here's a guy who claims to be God, and his prophet can call fire down from heaven. How do you deny that he's the God? His prophet can call fire down from heaven. So it's really, really deceptive. And Matthew says that it's going to be so deceptive that if it were possible, even God's elect would be deceived. And the reason it's not possible is not because there's anything in the elect that causes them to not be deceived. It's because they're God's chosen people and he acts on their behalf to keep them from being deceived. So this is going to be one humdinger of a deceptive kind of thing. And that's what it says in verse 9. This one is coming is in accordance with the standard of the act or the expenditures of energy by Satan to accomplish his objectives, and he's going to do it with power and signs and wonders that are not true. And then in verse 10, he adds, and with all the deception of unrighteousness for those who perish, because they didn't receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. That raises the fourth issue, not the power, signs, and false wonders, but also the deception. The deception is called the deception of unrighteousness, and this is the real reason why everything falls apart. Because deception means that something's being hidden, and what's being hidden is captured in the word unrighteousness. What is being hidden is the false motivation that is unrighteous. And that means then that it can't be trusted because the motive's false. In the true God's activities of using power, signs, and wonders is the reality of his underlying motivation. Not his power, his motivation for using it. And that's exactly where Satan hit Adam and Eve in the garden. Adam and Eve had, up to that point, believed that the God who had appeared to them to be the God, I mean, they were with him in the cool of the day in the garden. He was the one they conversed with. He's the one who planted them in the garden, gave them all this food to eat, all the water to drink, gave them the job he wanted them to do, gave Adam his wife. All of these things the God did, and it was on the basis of the statement that Moses summarized at the end of every day. It was good, which means he was good. His actions were good because he is. Satan came in the garden and said, first off, you won't die. So he contradicted him. And then he said, because God knows that if you eat that, you will know the truth about him. And he doesn't want you to know the truth about him. In other words, he's not as good as you think he is. He's not what he's cracked up to be. And I'm here to tell you that if you would eat that fruit, you would discover the truth that I'm telling you. And so from the very beginning, there was this desire to harm in the adversary. And his main deception is accusing the true God of having a false motivation. So that's the deception of unrighteousness. It's actually the best defense, the good offense. It's accusing God of being false before he can get in his accusation that you're the one that's being false. And Adam and Eve bought it. Unfortunately for all the rest of us, that's where all the issues of sin come from. But the fact is, it addresses the something that I said earlier, and that is, Satan has perceived of God as having the ultimate characteristic of power. Omnipotence is what makes God God. Well, that's a lie. It is true that omnipotence is a necessary attribute of any true God. But how that power is exercised is fundamentally crucial. And the scriptures never say God is power, but they do say God is love. So Satan, who despises the love reality, because to love means you have to be interested in other people's well-being, not your own. Exclusively not your own. Theirs. Well, Satan isn't any more interested in that philosophy than anything. He is not going there. He wants what he wants. It's all about me. Well, in an all-about-me deity, power then becomes compulsion, force, disaster for anybody that keeps you from getting your way. And that's the fundamental definition of God. But the true God says, no, love's the fundamental characteristic, and power is simply exercised in order to demonstrate the reality of the love. So, in the false God's activity, power, signs, and lying wonders are a totally self-destructive motivation, which means you're trying to harm other people. That's the bottom line. Harming others for your own personal gain. That's Satan. That's the man of sin. With the true God, power, signs, and wonders are about sharing the benefit. That's why the gospel is a promise of eternal life. And the signs and the powers and the wonders were produced in order to get people to believe the gospel so that they could enter into the life. Satan is not interested in that. And so there is this deception of wickedness. But that brings us to this issue of why does God let this mystery of iniquity or mystery of lawlessness develop to this point? And part of the answer is in verse 10. Those who are deceived are those who are perishing, and the reason they are is because they would not buy into the supremacy of the love of the truth. They refused. They didn't want the truth. They would rather have power than truth. And the end result of that is that the human beings are manipulated into sharing their power with allies that together will increase the impact that they're making, and that was the Tower of Babel thing, where God comes down and says, if we let these people go, there won't be anything they won't be able to do, so we need to confuse their languages to scatter them so that they can't bring all their power to bear on any given objective. That's the way human beings, and that's why how Satan thinks. We just get all this power and energize it in the right direction, we'll get what we want. But the true God, according to verse 10, permits this false opponent to achieve a great deal of power through alliances that's not rooted in love. But God is rooted in love, but he allows this development for one fundamental reason, and that is to bring out the final issue of what's valuable. And people who refuse to allow a love of the truth to be the most valuable characteristic are not only perishing, but they're going to perish. Because God is going to allow them to be deceived. And this means fundamentally, since the love for the truth will lead to salvation, this means fundamentally that they're not interested in salvation in the terms that God offers. And that means that they have been significantly corrupted by the mystery of the lawlessness to the point of no return. And that's why God allows it. So the roots of it are in Satan's opposition to God, and the reason for it is because a lot of humanity has bought into Satan's argument, and they have been corrupted to the point that there isn't any hope for them. And in that hopelessness, God responds in judgment. Once you've crossed over the line, there isn't anything else that God can do of benefit.